The following is offered by Discerning Hearts, a 501c3 nonprofit Catholic apostolate dedicated to spiritual formation through the use of new media. To download this selection, or to browse hundreds of other programs, or to contribute to our mission with a charitable donation which is fully tax deductible, visit our website at discerninghearts.com.
Welcome to the Formed Book Club, brought to you by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. On the program today, Ignatius Press founder and editor, Jesuit Father Joseph Fessio, Ignatius Press editor Vivian Doudreau, and best-selling author and editor Joseph Pierce. Join the program as they discuss Cardinal Robert Seurat's book, The Day Is Now Far Spent.
Welcome back to the Formed Book Club. We're continuing to discuss Robert Carlos Seurat's book, The Day Is Now Far Spent. We've already had 10 sessions. We probably have 2-3 more and we'll have it finished, but it's worth it. However, I want to make an announcement. We just were able to escape from a non-disclosure agreement on a new book on January 13th. It's been announced. It's co-authored by Pope Benedict Emeritus and Carlos Seurat. It's called From the Depths of Our Hearts. So we pause this video right now. Go on to the internet to Ignatius.com. Ignatius.com. Hope you can spell that correctly. And pre-order the book if you haven't done so. This is the book of the year. It's a wonderful book. It was occasioned by the Amazon Synod of late last year, in which the media magnified these potential changes in the church, one of which is to ordain married men in the Amazon. And because Pope Benedict and Carlos Seurat are friends and spend time together, and because Pope Benedict had been writing something on the priesthood, but because of his age and his weariness decided not to continue, he was encouraged by Carlos Seurat to finish that. And this book, From the Depths of Our Hearts by Carl Robert Seurat and Pope Benedict Emeritus, is not just about the priesthood and not just about celibacy, but about the church and the heart of the church. And they're not opposing Pope Francis, they're supporting Pope Francis. So, Vivian, you've looked at this. Do you have anything to add about this? Or
it's short.
Yes, so 148 pages, a fairly large print.
And it's written in a very, the title, From the Depths of Our Heart, this is written in a very heartfelt, personal sort of way, and so it's easy to read, it's easy to understand what they're trying to say about the true essence of the priesthood. Many of the things that we've talked about already, because they come up in this book, The Day Is Now Far Spent, it's well worth reading.
It is, and I think it's for everyone. By the way, I'm just not just trying to sell books. We do like to sell books, but why? I mean, we're a nonprofit organization. We do this to serve the church, to serve our Lord. I mean, when you have people like Carlos Seurat and Pope Benedict writing on something which is central to the church, I mean, this is something people ought to have, ought to read, ought to meditate on. And, I mean, buy one for your parish priest, buy one for your seminarian, you know. I mean, this is a book that it has an importance contemporarily because the topic is very, you know, disputed right now or discussed right now, but this is something that has a lasting value, it really has. In fact, I mean, when you read it, you'll see even there's been some claims. I will not mention what religious order has made these claims through its members, that, oh, Pope Benedict didn't write this. Yes, okay. You read what Pope Benedict has in his section on this thing. His voice is clear. He has written this. And it's about the priesthood. And the interesting thing is, he says, this crisis has been going on for a long time. A lot of priests are discouraged because of the sexual abuse crisis. But even after the council, there's a question, what is the priesthood anyway? What does it mean? And he goes right to the root. He says, there was a misunderstanding even after the council of how to interpret the Old Testament. That the priesthood, because Jesus was a layman, the apostles were laymen, none of them were part of the tribe of Levi, that Jesus abolished the cultic priesthood. But Ratzinger shows that the cultic priesthood of Levi and Aaron was fulfilled in Christ. And he quotes the psalm he remembers from the day he was ordained, back in 1951, I think it was, maybe before that, Psalm 16, verses 5 and 6, "The Lord is my portion and my cup. My lot has fallen on beautiful places. My heritage is the Lord." And he says, why was that? He said, because of the 12 tribes of Israel, 11 had land. But the 12th tribe, the tribe of Levi, the priestly tribe, had no land. Why? Because their sustenance, their life, was to be given to and received from the Lord, dependent upon God. And that led to the New Testament fulfillment of that in the Catholic priesthood, with celibacy, meaning I give up wife and family for my spouse, which is the church. Anyway,
That's one of the proof of authorships, I think.
That's right.
Because this, he has in other places talked about this psalm being so important to him personally, in understanding this abandonment to God that's called this part of the calling of a priest, and what that means for the essence of the priesthood. He's written about this in other places.
Yeah, in fact, he quotes himself in this. He quotes himself.
And just the way it's all done, it's clear. The authorship is clear. Maybe he dictated it. I don't know. But don't get hung up on authorship. Yeah. We know who the real author is.
Well, Joseph, I'm sorry we sprang this on you without any preparation. But anyway, that's
well,
it.
I would just say that I'm delighted to have anything new by Pope Emeritus Benedict. His papacy was marked not just by his sanctity and his sanity, but by his coherence. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing the church certainly needs is coherence. And having Pope Emeritus' voice back in the mix is something we should all rejoice in.
So back to this other wonderful book by Carlo Serra. We're still on part three, which is the longest part of the four parts in the book. And we are on chapter 9, Europe's Crisis. But Europe's crisis is not just Europe's crisis for a number of reasons. One, we're tributary to Europe. We are. And secondly, the decaying parts of the European church, which I won't mention geographically or by name, are trying to, in their last gasp, infect everyone else. Mm-hmm. So it's important to understand the problems in Europe and inoculate ourselves against them. So, I have something at the very beginning of chapter 9 on page 220, because in the very first, so I know I'm before anybody on this one. Nicholas Dia asks Carlo Serra, or says, in this chapter, the great book by Joseph Ratzinger, Europe Today and Tomorrow, subtitle. That book is a book which we republished with a different title. We call it Western Culture Today and Tomorrow because it precisely is more than just Europe. Mm-hmm. But again, on this particular chapter, if you want to get a little more depth to it, Ignatius.com, get that republished book we have called Western Culture Today and Tomorrow by Joseph Ratzinger, Cardinal Ratzinger. All right. I got someone page 221. Joseph, can you trump me?
I can, actually. I can trump you. I've got something towards the bottom of 220.
Okay.
There's two sentences towards the bottom of that page that I want to just pluck out and comment upon.
Okay.
Europe seems to be programmed to self-destruct. That's a typical Cardinal Serra provocative statement I want to comment upon. And then just at the bottom there, the West seems to hate itself and to be ready to commit suicide. Now, I think that what I want to draw the attention to here, I think it's very important for us to distinguish between the Europe of the faith, as Hilaire Belloc would call it, or Christendom, and the Europe of the Enlightenment, which is a rejection of Christendom. Because I think very often people talk about the West in a conflated way, where we try to throw all of this Western stuff together in the same pot. And what you have then is a cauldron which is actually fighting against itself. So I think it's very important for us to know that the Europe which is programmed to self-destruct is the Europe that took itself on the path of pride with the philosophers of the Enlightenment, And this is playing itself out now, two or three centuries on, in this self-destruction, in this culture of death, in this suicide of the West. But the West that's committing suicide is not the church. It's not Christendom. We need to distinguish between the two.
And it's also important to distinguish between two enlightenments, which Joseph Ratzinger did over and over again in many of his writings, where some of the discussion after the horrid period of religious warfare in Europe and this attempt to bring about religious toleration in the different European countries, you know, he says this was a project worth doing, and that not all the Enlightenment thinkers should be thrown in the same cauldron either, that we need to have discernment in picking out those who are actually anti-God, anti-Christ, anti-church, anti-origins of Europe, versus the ones who were simply trying to actually call Europe and Christendom to its true principles. So I just throw that out there. That's a theme, a constant theme in the writings of Cardinal Ratzinger.
Yeah, if there's another constant theme of Cardinal Ratzinger is the hermeneutic of rupture versus the hermeneutic
right.
of continuum. And where Enlightenment thinkers are making a significant break with that continuum, which is Christendom, which includes scholastic philosophy, they are actually making the break that leads to the mess that Europe's in now. So I would agree with you, but I think that when most people think of Enlightenment philosophers, they think of a handful of well-known ones, all of which are actually the seed of the problem.
And this has an echo or a parallel in the idea of revolution, because you know, America had its revolution in 1776 and thereabouts, and France had its in 1789 and thereabouts, but they were two different forms of revolution, two different forms of understanding the state. And even though someone like Jefferson was kind of a deist, and he had his own Bible where he crossed all the lines that were kind of miraculous, but he still was a Christian, and the others, you know, in our founding fathers were Christian of one sort or another. They did not reject Christianity when they rejected the monarchy of England and the imposition of, you know, taxation of the representation.
In fact, more importantly, what they were doing was dusting off the natural law tradition that had been carried through scholasticism into European Christianity and had been supplanted by absolutism, monarchical absolutism. And so the American Revolution was really an attempt to put monarchical absolution into its place by reinvigorating a natural law tradition that would have other principles of justice besides just the will of the monarch. And that debate is still worth having. And so we do have to be careful about not just throwing everything into the same pot because it came from the same time period, or even gets certain labels such as Enlightenment and so on. I think we really need to be careful to see that, like you're saying, there's a hermeneutic of continuity in Christian thinking, whether it's thinking about the church or thinking about the civil order. There's a Christian continuity that's worth keeping alive. And it takes a little bit of effort to do that instead of just throwing labels around.
So I want to go to page 221. We're going to advance here a tremendous amount. We're going to go one page forward.
Better than two pages backwards.
And Diaz says, the picture you paint is terrible. Could Europe be dead already? Question mark.
Not dead yet.
And Carlos Serra responds, I think it is on its last legs. A process of self-destruction is always reversible, but time is short. For several years, the decline has been accelerating. All civilizations that ignore the eminent dignity of the human person have vanished. Today, as at the time of the Roman Empire, Europe manipulates, commercializes, and toys with human life. thus creating the conditions for its own extinction. So, I mean, you know, there's something refreshing about, you know, an African village boy who grows up and makes good and gets an education from, you know, European sources and now can speak our language and can speak with clarity. Mm-hmm. He goes on, the rejection of life, and he just, here's this list, the rejection of life, the murder of preborn children, the murder of the handicapped and the elderly, the demolition of the family and the moral and spiritual values. All this is the first act in the tragedy of a suicide of an entire people. We are helpless spectators at the decline of a civilization. Europe's nosedive is unique in the history of humanity. I mean, okay, it looks pretty bleak. But then the next paragraph, however, I must add that in Europe, alongside the institutions that seem suicidal and decadent, there are true seeds of renewal. I met many generous families that are deeply rooted in their Christian faith. I've also seen fine religious communities that are faithful and fervent. They remind me of the Christians who, in the twilight years of the Roman Empire, kept watch over the flickering flames of civilization. I want to encourage them. So his analysis, his, you know, diagnosis of the disease is not to say, well, let's give it all up.
We'll return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce in just a moment. Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app in which you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Deacon James Keating, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more are found on the Discerning Hearts free app. Did you also know that you can stream Discerning Hearts programming on numerous streaming platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and so many more? And did you know that Discerning Hearts also has the YouTube page? Be sure to check out all these different places where you can find Discerning Hearts. A prayer of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.
Hello, my name is Deacon Omar Gutierrez, and I want to ask you to support Discerning Hearts in a special way. We, Chris McGregor, the board, and I all know that not everyone listening can help financially. We know we have listeners from all parts of the world, and we have made a commitment since the beginning to make the truths shared through Discerning Hearts totally free. So while you may not be able to contribute financially, what you can do is certainly pray, but also give us positive reviews on whatever platform you use to listen to us. If it's iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, however it is that you get these podcasts, or if you're on YouTube and you like our videos, please give us a good rating and write a review. The more good ratings and reviews we get, the higher our profile, and the more listeners will discover us, listeners who may have the means to contribute in the future. Please consider rating us and writing a positive review today.
We now return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce.
Yeah, I would say also, Father, I also highlighted the same two paragraphs here, and you know, right through to the end of the paragraph. As you say, the good thing about this book, that's also the problem when you're discussing it, is when do you stop reading it? Because it's so quotable. But I would just reemphasize what I was saying earlier, the Europe that's dying is the Europe of pride. And that Europe is like the Roman Empire that was dying in the 5th century. It's distinct from the church. It's distinct from Christendom. It's distinct from Christianity. And the fact that this Europe is nosediving towards the abyss in its suicidal self-destruction is not something that takes us down with it, although, of course, it may be messy and it may lead to martyrdoms, because it may well be that this has to happen so that something healthier can emerge from the ashes.
Yes, but these people that are sinking are nominally Christian. And we had a Christian civilization in North Africa flourishing in the 5th and 6th centuries and 7th until Islam completely wiped them out. So it's possible that the church, which will last until the end of time, may not continue, for example, in Ephesus, you know, or in, you know, places where Paul wrote letters to the Colossus and so on. Those are no longer Christian places. But here, to finish this thing, I want to tell them, your mission is not to save a dying world. No civilization has a promise of eternal life. Your mission is to live out with fidelity and without compromise the faith you receive from Christ. In that way, even without realizing it, you will save the heritage of many centuries of faith. Do not be afraid because of your small numbers. It is not a matter of winning elections or influencing opinions. It is a matter of living the gospel. Not thinking of it as a utopia, but experience it concretely. Faith is like a fire. The person himself must be on fire in order to be able to transmit it. Watch over this sacred fire! Exclamation point, he says. May it be your heat in the depths of the winter of the West. When a fire illumines the night, people gradually gather around it. That must be your hope.
Well, that was exactly what I was trying to say. I don't think that anybody
really
sparing because Europe is in a desperate state, because what's in a desperate state is the culture of despair. So I just think we need to be Christians. We need to be courageous. We need to have a catacomb mentality. And that's fine. I am very comfortable with all of that.
This is a very important paragraph because, you know, the world is always dying. The things that are not of God are always dying. And so the role of the Christian in every time and place is simply to be faithful and to trust that God, even though things are dying away, God is also always at work bringing new life and renewal. Just last night at Mass, there was a Chinese Dominican seminarian, novice, and he grew up in Beijing in an atheistic family. And he confronted death somehow in his life. He didn't go into details, but he said that this really disturbed him. And he kept asking his parents and his grandmother, if we all die, if everything's dying away, what's the point of anything? And he was just a little boy asking these questions. Imagine this, in an atheistic family, an atheistic culture, and he's asking these questions. And he said one night he went to bed and he wept on his pillow, God, if you exist, please guide me. And it wasn't until years later, he was an exchange student in the U.S., and guess what? His host family was Catholic, and they took him to Mass. And that was the first time he'd ever experienced a Mass or any Christian worship. And he right away saw that there was a God, and he was answering those prayers that he made as a little boy crying on his pillow.
Wow.
And here he is now, a Dominican seminarian. He went on to study biochemical engineering and all these things. And I'm telling you, I was all choked up. And I went away from Mass so encouraged. You know, the Holy Spirit is at work in this world. God is calling all men and women to himself. And yes, things rise, things fall, civilizations come, civilizations go. But the eternal truth of God never dies.
I'm really pleased you used the example of someone from China, because, again, you know, we look at the situation we find ourselves in, and if we have a worldly perspective, it looks desperate. But
yes,
it's not as desperate as things were in China during the midst of the Cultural Revolution, where tens of millions of people were being put to death, where there was no Christian roots in the culture. It was just atheism with a remnant of Confucianism or what have you. And now we see that the church and Christians in a more general sense in China, one of the fastest growing parts of Christendom. So the point is that we need to be take that longer view, that the Tolkienian view, you know, that basically that the history is a long defeat in the sense that the world is always destroying itself in its own pride. But beyond that is the eternal vision of God. And all of us leave this long history very quickly and actually go into that bigger, better, perfect history, which is the presence of God.
But we all play our little part. This family, this Catholic family that took him to Mass, they were just being faithful to who they are. They had no idea that when this man, you know, when he was younger, crying in his pillow, they had no idea they were part of God's saving work in this world. They were just being faithful to their Catholic faith and sharing it with others. Now this young man going on to becoming a Dominican priest, who knows how many souls he will help to save. And that family will have played that part of taking a young man to Mass. I'm telling you, I just left church last night on so built up that God is at work. All we need to do is be faithful to what he's asking us to do in our own small way.
I never read about that family in the Washington Post or CNN.
No, and you never
will. They must not be worth anything.
See? I mean, the world just passes over some little family going to Mass, but I took so much encouragement from this paragraph. Your mission is not to save a dying world. Your mission is to live out with fidelity the faith you've received from Christ. If everyone with faith just does that, they are saving this world.
And to remember that our kingdom is not of this world.
That's right.
And we should not invest ourselves too much in worldly things. And perhaps part of the beatific vision is seeing how our little actions of faith throughout our lives helped our brothers and sisters, in the shipwreck of the fallen world. And maybe that's part of what we see.
That's right.
Wow, that's good. Okay, so let's see.
Where do we go?
I have another one on page 226 here at the bottom.
Can I interrupt you?
Go ahead. There's something before that, Joseph?
I'm going to stand 222, but I'm happy to move on.
Go ahead. 222. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's just towards the bottom, the penultimate, the last full paragraph on that page. It seems that the European techno structures are delighted about the migratory flows or encourage them. They reason only in economic terms. They need workers who can be paid little. They ignore the identity and the culture of every people. Just look at their overt contempt for the Polish government. Liberal ideology takes precedence over any other approach. As at Bethlehem, God is the only poor person for whom there is no room at the inn. I don't know if I need to say anything about that. I just wanted to... You know, I've just come back from Europe. I was in Europe in Budapest. I think I mentioned this last week, but before in mid-December, and European techno structures, in other words, the European Union and its bureaucracies, you know, are actually facilitating this flow of Islamic migrants into Europe, which is ultimately culturally and probably economically and politically self-destructive.
Right. Now, Cardinal does mention later on that, you know, if there had been some effort to bring about a positive integration of Christian Europe being itself and sharing itself and sharing its riches with the stranger and foreigner and so on, that would be different. But instead, it's just allowing waves upon waves of people with not much hope of assimilating. And where are we?
It's the self-hatred, as he mentions elsewhere.
It's the self-hatred. You know, if you loathe yourself, you're not going to share yourself with somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's got to be a way of both welcoming the refugee and so on, and yet sharing yourself when you bring him into your home. Why are we not doing that? That's what the cardinal is.
There's one in the book, and what people such as President Orbán are saying in Hungary is what the problem should be solved, if possible, on the ground where they are. In other words, we should be trying to find ways of helping people economically where they live, rather than creating such an upheaval where they live that they feel forced to leave, although many of them are not forced to leave, but that's another issue. But now the problem is to solve it locally where it is, not to have a globalized problem leading to globalized upheavals.
Right. And as the Cardinal points out, though, it's the pursuit of cheap labor. And some European government officials have been very forthright about that. That, look, we're not having enough children. We're running out of workers. We need to bring these people in here to do these jobs. And the same thing in the United States. That's where population growth is coming from primarily in this country as well, is migration. And so the leaders of these countries are very honest about what their motives are. It's all economics.
All right. Anything before page 226?
All yours as far as I'm concerned.
Keep going, Father.
All right. So this is towards the bottom of the page 226. This is my last one in this chapter here, which is a short chapter, but worth taking all the time we've taken on it. We are helplessly witnessing the passage from a human age to a bestial age. He doesn't really pull his punches. Two kinds of barbarism are confronting each other. A materialist barbarism and another Islamist one. I fear that the second one will have the last word. This reminds me of the very strong words spoken by Carlo Ratzinger during a conference that he gave in July 1987, and he quotes, "In the name of an ambiguity between pluralism and religious liberty, they have completely separated the Christian fact from the requirement to shape the public order. The idea of a state that is completely not neutral with regard to values, a state that keeps its distance from any religious and moral order, is absurd." Boltman himself, Boltman was a very liberal Protestant religious exegete, but had some good ideas. Boltman himself said that although a non-Christian state is conceivable, an atheist state is not. I think that it is very important to remind consciences of the political and social dimension of Christianity in its unalterable character as a public fact. So again, the naked public square, that we can't have a state which is atheistic, that is already a religion. And so that is my last underlined part.
Just something else on page 227, but really only in passing. I just wanted to
highlight
this, really. So the middle of page 227, the powerful media use every means to try to break up the remnants of Christianity. The media system, the one genuine thought police, runs from one battle to the next in its campaign to transform man. So I love the idea that he's actually saying that the present media, with its nonstop propaganda, is a thought police, connecting it with, 1984, George Orwell, and, of course, the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century.
All right. Well, we have covered one important but short chapter. And so next week, we'll come back with Chapter 10, The Errors of the West. Thanks for joining, and God bless you.
Thank you for joining us for the Formed Book Club, brought to you by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. For more information on how you can instantly get thousands of movies, faith-filled programs, audio presentations, and ebooks, go to formed.org. To get a copy of the book discussed on this program, Cardinal Seurat's The Day Is Now Far Spent, go to your local Catholic bookstore or online at ignatius.com.